hole for this.
With heroes in London, New York, Jerusalem, and Potero, this is Shine Network News, weekend in Sunday, June 12, 2005.
Hi, I'm your host, Tom Payne. Only the name has been changed to prevent an investigation. This is the official podcast of silentrunning.tv, which is an Anglospheric group blog. If you don't know what the Anglosphere is, stick around. In the program this week, we'll have more from black Christian conservative activist and blogger LaShawn Barber about the reactions she gets from white liberals.
Not too long ago, whites used to joke that all black people looked alike and they couldn't tell us apart. The fact that I think differently and that shocks them is just sort of an updated version of that. Well, we don't all think alike either.
Later on, a guy who's received quite a bit of attention in the blogs for writing a great essay called Leaving the Left. From the California coastline, it's writer Keith Thompson, who now regrets his former preconceptions about conservatives.
The right seems to be reactionary, selfish, greedy people. And in fact, liberalism of the kind that I join has now become in its own way as reactionary, as greedy, and as power-oriented as any other movement I've ever encountered.
And of course, between LaShawn and Keith, we have the Full of Crap report from Lawrence Simon. This week, guess who's full of crap? It's Amnesty International, of course, for describing Guantanamo Bay as the gulag of our times, without anything resembling what you or I will certain other clueless no-hopers might call a reason to do so. But first up, blog news. The growing influence of blogs was highlighted this week when St. Bob Geldof took part in a conference call with bloggers to talk up his Live 8 concert for Africa. John Hinderaker of Powerline helped to organise several right-wing bloggers to participate, while Joe Trippi got those on the left to take part. By the way, I love that name, Joe Trippi. Does he live in San Francisco? It's a good roundup of how the chat went at Citizen Smash. Some participants are still a bit sceptical about the concert, questioning the usefulness of Western aid and debt relief when the answer to African poverty, many people believe, lies in African nations really getting their act together. But other right-wing bloggers have clearly gone all googly-eyed after being addressed directly by St. Bob, and they're much more enthusiastic about it than they were. The government of China, frequently accused of violating press freedom, is clamping down on blogs. It's ordering them to follow existing registration requirements for other internet websites. Bloggers have to register their sites and identify the person responsible for each one by the end of June, according to the Information Industry Ministry. The ministry says almost 75% of all websites have already been registered. The regulations are needed, it says, because of sex, violence, superstitions, and other harmful information available online. Other harmful information. Fortunately, the internet's pretty much the ultimate tool of Western cultural imperialism, and it interprets censorship as damage and simply routes information around it. I predict those hundreds of thousands of Chinese computer science graduates may be able to put their skills to good use, finding holes in the great firewall of China. More information on this issue is available at townhall.com. Victor Davis Hanson has a new essay out with the typically self-explanatory title, Western Liberalism is the Only Idea Left Standing. And no, by liberalism he doesn't mean driving to a Greenpeace Save the Endangered Tree Sloth rally in a hybrid car with a bumper sticker reading Visualize World Peace. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Dr. Hanson, he's a professor of classics at Fresno State University in California. He's a raisin farmer, and possibly the most insightful military historian writing about the war today. Here's a taste of what he thinks of the collapse of the European Constitution, which we reported with some glee recently. The French and Dutch rebuffs of the European Union Constitution will soon be followed by other rejections. Millions of proud, educated Europeans are tired of being told by unelected grandees that the mess they see is really abstract art. The EU Constitution and its promise of a new Europe supposedly offered a corrective to the Anglo-American strain of Western civilization. More government, higher taxes, richer entitlements, pacifism, statism, and atheism would make a more humane and powerful new continent of more than 400 million to outpace a retrograde US. Instead, Europe faces a declining population, unassimilated minorities, low growth, high unemployment, and an inability to defend itself, either militarily or morally. Somehow, the director of the EU has figured out how to have too few citizens while having too many of them out of work. For people who like to explore the new audio side of blogging, which is just starting to take off, the Rip and Read blog is becoming an essential site. It's done by a guy called Charlie Quidnuck, who lives on Mercer Island in Washington State. He keeps an eye on what's going on, puts up audio, and has some pungent comments to make about it as well. Here's an item he highlighted this week, the congressional hearings on the Patriot Act. This is the committee chair, James Sensenbrenner, Republican from Wisconsin, who was winding proceedings up after the Democrats started going on about Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo Bay, terror suspects, pretty much anything except the Patriot Act, which is what they were there to talk about. Sensenbrenner wasn't too happy about this and basically closed the meeting, leaving the Democrats bitching and whining and calling for points of order.
The Patriot Act has nothing to do with Guantanamo Bay. The Patriot Act has nothing to do with enemy combatants. The Patriot Act has nothing to do with indefinite detentions. I think particularly irresponsible and indicative of the broad brush accusations of the Patriot Act was what I just heard, saying the Patriot Act has resulted in Minutemen being on the border. That's not true, and that's irresponsible, and I think anybody who knows what is going on will see. No, I will not yield. We'll see that fact. I think this hearing very, very clearly shows what the opponents of the Patriot Act are doing. They'll talk about practically everything but what's in the Patriot Act and what this committee is considering. So thank you all for coming today. I thank the members for changing their schedules to participate, and the committee is adjourned.
Point of order, Mr. Chairman.
Wacky fun. There's plenty more audio at ripandread.blogspot.com. Tell them Shire News Network sent you. Zimbabwe's attempt to emulate the economic reforms which made the Khmer Rouge so justifiably famous in the 1970s continues apace. Robert Mugabe, who was apparently competing with Pol Pot in an historical contest to determine just how fast you can destroy an entire country, is now ordering the destruction of markets. Quite how people are supposed to feed themselves is either not important to him, or in fact it's not a bug, it's a feature. The anti-government forces, and Lord knows that has to encompass anyone in Zimbabwe with at least half a brain cell, called for a 4-day stay away, but that seems to have flopped. The mainstream media are studiously downplaying the slow, agonizing death of the former breadbasket of Africa, so blogs are taking up as much of the slack as possible. Go to Zimbabwe Pundit at zimpundit.blogspot.com, and that would be the best introduction to this horrible, horrible situation. If you haven't already discovered him, you should be reading Minneapolis columnist James Lilacs, who's simply one of the best writers in the world today. He has a site called The Bleat, which talks about his life, how many columns he has to write that day, the latest cute thing his toddler daughter's just said, what music he's listening to on his iPod. Okay, he has this knack of making it a lot more interesting than that sounds. Occasionally he ventures into politics and culture, but a little tentatively, and he almost always apologizes for it. Well, no more. James Lilacs has added a new part to his site, devoted entirely to the current unpleasantness, shall we call it. This includes the cultural war that's raging in the West as well. To give you a little taste of his writing, here's an excerpt from his take on Democratic National Committee Chairman Howard Dean's latest swipe at the Republican Party, saying they all look and behave the same, calling it a white Christian party. Here's James Lilacs. It surely hurts to see the head of the party jam his foot so far in his mouth that the tassels of his loafers dangle from his buttocks. It must rankle the moderates to hear him fling this nonsense on a daily basis. After all, it's like having Pat Buchanan run the GOP and make constant fulminating speeches against commie lesbo vegans. The latter group might consider that Dr. Dean's reliable skill for vomiting undigested red meat on cue doesn't endear them to moderates. But moderation isn't what they want anyway, unless you count crucifying Bush but letting him climb down after half a day as moderation. The University of Oregon is rethinking a diversity plan that would have required cultural competence to be considered in hiring, funding, and tenure decisions. Under the plan, the new criteria would include such things as exhibits capacity to promote equity of student access and outcomes. Well, I imagine that means quotas. Advocates for social justice. Well, we're going to be discussing social justice just a bit later in this podcast. Here's a good one. Ability to receive and integrate critiques of cultural competence. Critiques. Is that anything like the self-criticism sessions that Red Guards used to force people to undergo during the Chinese Cultural Revolution? Interesting. Shows a commitment to continuous education about the educational implications of race, class, and language diversity. Okay, I have no idea what that means. Maybe it means precisely what those who will interpret it want it to mean. Maybe it means more Red Guard-style self-criticism. Who knows? Ability to engage in personal self-reflection around issues of race, ethnicity, class, and privilege. I suppose this means they'll force everyone to wear Mao jackets and study the Little Red Book while they abuse professors as running dog lackeys of imperialism. Maybe the academic left's just nostalgic for the Cultural Revolution. Exhibits non-judgmental openness to new experiences. What, like reading a book by Thomas Sowell? No, I suppose that's not what they mean by new experiences. Understands the history of oppressed groups, such as conservative academics. I'm sorry. I'll volunteer for an 18-hour self-criticism session immediately. I have a bourgeois class background, and I think one of my grandfathers once owned property. I really shouldn't be permitted to speak in public. All hail the teachings of Chomsky. You know, American parents pay the highest university fees for their children of any nation on earth. Why? More details about this mishgoss at the University of Oregon can be found at Joanne Jacobs' blog. And finally, in blog news, here's an observation that's been floating around the blogosphere for a while. If you consider that there have been an average of 160,000 troops in the Iraqi theater during the last 22 months, that gives a firearm death ratio of 60 per 100,000. The firearm death ratio in Washington, D.C. is 80.6 per 100,000. This means you are more likely to be shot and killed in the American capital, which has some of the strictest gun control laws in the nation, than you are in Iraq. Well, there's only one inescapable conclusion from these facts. The U.S. government should immediately pull out of Washington, D.C. You're listening to Shire Network News, the official podcast of silentrunning.tv. Okay, that's enough blog news. Let's get to the interviews. Last week, we had the first part of a chat with prominent Washington, D.C. area blogger LaShawn Barber. Here's the second half, in which she warns that liberals run the risk of alienating black people because they simply fail to understand the importance of the Christian faith to the black community.
They sort of downplay it. They may mention the word church or something like that, but you very seldom see the word Christian. That's an untouchable word.
Do you get different reactions from white people and black people when it comes out that you're a conservative?
Yes. From white people, I tend to get the shocking look. From black people, I tend to get the confused and angry looks, because usually blacks have a knee-jerk reaction to what they've heard about conservatives. Like I said, I try to stress conservative, and I hardly ever use the word Republican, but in their minds, there's really no difference. But I do it anyway just to make a point. When I say that I'm a conservative, I start expressing conservative ideas, the looks on their faces, how could you as a black woman support a party like that? And then I just talk about some of the things I've learned and some of the historical inaccuracies about the Republican Party in general. And even though I do vote for Republicans, I don't consider myself an apologist for Republicans. I don't jump up to defend them every chance I get. But when talking to black people, I do have to do a little more defending. I think the difference with them and with white people is that they're just completely shocked that a black woman in general, especially in this area, is a George Bush voter.
It's kind of insulting in a way to actually think that, because they're sort of putting you in a pigeonhole. You're a black woman, therefore you will think this and anything different, and you're off the reservation. You can't do that.
Right. And I try to emphasize the fact that, you know, not too long ago, whites used to joke that all black people looked alike and they couldn't tell us apart. The fact that I think differently and that shocks them is just sort of an updated version of that. Well, we don't all think alike either. We do have diverse opinions. I think I'm a lot more vocal than other people. I've just always been outspoken, no matter what my view was. So being an outspoken conservative and Christian is really nothing new to me or my family. But people in general just seem to be either very angry or they consider me a breath of fresh air. Whatever kind of emotion I invoke in them, I'm glad because at least they're thinking, their passions are aroused, maybe we can talk and sort of straighten out some of the misunderstandings.
Obviously, a lot of black people think the Republican Party is full of guys with pickup trucks with gun racks and Confederate flags on the back and so forth, or they're top-hatted, you know, millionaires who want to grind the faces of the poor. What's your experience been of being on the right wing of politics? What sort of reception has someone like you had from the people on the right of politics in America?
I do more writing about it than I actually have been doing, I guess, socializing or meeting. I resist joining groups. I, you know, receive invitations to join this group or that group, especially the Republican Party. I first registered to vote when I was 25. I registered independent, and I voted for Bill Clinton, and I never changed my registration, and I'm so glad I didn't because I don't want to actually belong to a particular party. The white conservatives I meet are not shocked. They're pleasantly surprised. And these are the ones that tell me I'm like a breath of fresh air because they were wondering, you know, where the conservative black people were because they knew that we had to exist. I mean, if you had people, a certain percentage of blacks voting for Republicans, they had to be somewhere. So I just sprung from out of nowhere in the blogosphere and hit the scene. And I think part of my popularity is due to the fact that I am an outspoken black conservative woman, and a lot of white people, white conservatives, can't say half the things I say because they'd be called racist. And I know I have a lot of readers who don't comment on my blog, and they read it every day, and it's almost as if I'm speaking for them, because if they said just a fraction of what I said, they'd be branded racist. So the experience I've had with white conservatives in general has been very positive. Like I said, they're very eager for me to get involved in things, not necessarily to use me, but they do want more of us to be involved with the party because they are trying to attract more of the black vote. And I guess in a way they're trying to get inside information about why blacks are resistant to voting for Republicans. And I mean, I have my own ideas. I can't speak for all black people, but it's just the same reasons that I never voted for them. I grew up with Democrat voting parents, and I was politically apathetic, but I knew I was supposed to vote for Democrats. That's just the way it was. And as I got older, I just started examining who I was, what I believed, realized I didn't believe half the things that Democrats pushed, and not shortly after I became a conservative, I became a Christian, and that sort of solidified my political leaning to the point where I'm not going to be knowingly voting for a pro-choice or an abortion-supporting candidate, and Republicans tend not to be pro-abortion candidates, so I predict I'll probably vote for them as long as I'm able to vote.
That was LaShawn Barber. Well, just before we talk to the author of the essay Leaving the Left, I think it's time to welcome Lawrence Simon.
Hi there, I'm Lawrence Simon, and I'm here to tell you who's full of crap this week in the Full of Crap Report, right here on Shire News Network. Amnesty International is often known for petulant outbursts against the few free democracies it can freely operate within. Amnesty's number one target these days is the good old U.S. of A. I quote, "Guantanamo has become the gulag of our time," Amnesty International Secretary General Irene Khan. Let's take a look at what a real gulag is. Millions of prisoners, whole families, not just men, women, children, babies, horrifying environmental conditions, mass starvation, little or no medical treatment, medical experimentation, hard labor, the worst of which featured uranium mining, decontaminating nuclear subs, and human subjects for nuclear exposure testing, and even colonization, the forced settlement of distant lands. Sound familiar, Australia and New Zealand? What is Guantanamo? It's a military base on the tip of Cuba that has been used recently for the detainment and interrogation of 550 of the worst terrorists, jihadis, and bloodthirsty scum picked up in the war on terror. Medical treatment is not just available, but constant, and what were once rudimentary jail cells and open pens are now air-conditioned buildings with commons areas. Forced labor camps? Hardly. No uranium mining or scrubbing out our nuclear fleet. It's just pray, exercise, eat, sleep, and frequent attempts to ambush and murder their keepers. We're not talking about dissident intellectuals like Solzhenitsyn writing well-reasoned screeds against Bush here. We're talking about ruthless nutbag killers, terrorist masterminds, and enemy combatants caught in the act of trying to murder U.S. troops. The real mistake that the United States had made with many of these detainees is not offing them in the field with summary executions, or finishing them off with military tribunals. It's in the Geneva Conventions, folks. Look it up. However, in our haste, we put down the playbook, and we left the door wide open enough for our moral inferiors to stick their Birkenstocks and thobes in the door. So, after calling Guantanamo a gulag, we eventually found out what basis Guantanamo was being called a gulag. None. That's right. Amnesty International Executive Director William Schultz admitted on American television that he had no idea what the conditions were in Guantanamo. Not a clue. Amnesty International's report is based mostly on the testimony of prisoners. 100% unreliable. These jihadis were specifically trained to lie about their treatment and torture at the hands of the Americans. Why? Because idiots on the left believe this crap, because so-called moderate Muslims get pissed off, and because it convinces jihadis to avoid surrender and keep up their insane eternal war on civilization. Amnesty International swallows it all up as gospel, the fools. You know, once upon a time there were real Russian gulags. And you know what? There still are gulags on this planet. They're in Libya, cutting the tongues out of those who question the Green Book of Muammar Gaddafi. They're in Syria, full of Kurds who have the temerity to demand independence from the bloody Baathist regime of Bashar Assad. They're in North Korea, filled with hundreds of thousands of political prisoners, women, children, babies. Sound familiar? Unfortunately, dictators tend to look unfavorably upon critics, like Amnesty International. Squealers get vanished, blown away, or stuck in these modern-day real gulags. So, Amnesty is left to make up fantasies based on what they don't know against an easy target like America. Gee, what a horrible place America has become. I can't pick up a newspaper without reading how Bush has had Amnesty International officers rounded up and exiled to drill for oil in Anwar, or had them all executed for demanding that he be tried for war crimes. Sorry, that hasn't happened. Silly me making things up, like some jackass from Amnesty International. Bush called them fools, and justifiably so. Amnesty International, you're full of crap.
That's Lawrence Simon, whose blog, Full of Crap, is well worth bookmarking. Don't listen to the name, it's very funny. You're listening to Shire Network News, the official podcast of silentrunning.tv. Now, finally in the program, I'm very happy to introduce you to a writer that I hope we're going to be hearing a lot more from in the future. He's Keith Thompson, and in a story that's become oh so familiar to many of us in recent years, he started out as a liberal and has now moved over towards the right. But unlike many, he wrote about it in a San Francisco area newspaper and put his email address at the bottom. Now, that's some guts right there. I asked Keith Thompson to explain his political evolution.
I've been in the process of reevaluating, to put it mildly, the whole left liberal worldview for quite some time. I wrote my essay, Leaving the Left, more as an announcement of a process that was really complete and a desire to make that known almost as a manifesto. But for the past decade easily, I have been in a kind of quiet and private rebellion against the assumptions of the left, and in many ways coming to terms with the fact that I identify much more with the conservative, libertarian, federalist, constitutionalist, whatever you want to call it, movement on the so-called right.
For many people, this is always a problem because they identify the words conservative or right-wing as simply synonymous with evil.
That's right. I mean, well, evil at worst, at best, it's identified with the status quo. And so people who have been committed to change and wanting to see positive change, it is very tempting to identify with the left. What I have come to realize is how very hard it is to argue with, at least with the appeal. It's very hard to argue with the appeal of terms like compassion, diversity, tolerance, inclusion, and pluralism. In the right context, and in the hands and in the minds of intelligent and critically reasonable people, those are good ideas. Those are virtues. But in the hands of people who want to enforce equality, they can be very dangerous. And so it's a whole step away from that that's required, and it involves reformulating not only what you think the left is about, but also taking a second look at what the right is about and questioning and reevaluating the whole idea that the right is opposed to change. Actually, I see most of the creative change is coming now from the right, because in fact, the left, while it loves to talk about being marginalized and representing itself as being out of power, the left is now the status quo in the United States in terms of the cultural dynamic.
You say that it's taken you a long time, perhaps about a decade. What first got you starting to reevaluate the thing? Because that's the most important thing, is that most people never even take that first step.
Yeah, for me it was when I was on the, I was a member, I love politics. I grew up even when I was in my teens, age 16, I fell in love with politics, and I was drawn to the liberal agenda back in the 1970s. This was the time when Vietnam didn't seem to be a smart decision, and when civil rights were still coming forward in the United States, and the women's movement still seemed to be about equality rather than about a kind of wholesale male bashing, which is what it's become, a very pathological movement by and large. So I was attracted to liberalism. I was never programmatically drawn to the left, and I certainly wasn't a revolutionary. I ended up joining the U.S. Senate staff of Ohio Senator Howard Metzenbaum, who's no longer in office but was one of the most liberal members. And one of the turning points for me came when Metzenbaum proposed legislation to declare the Cuyahoga Valley National Recreation Area in northeast Ohio. And the effect of that legislation was to declare a vast amount of land, a federal park, if you will, and the effect of it was to force people who lived there to sell their homes to the Park Service. It destroyed the community, it destroyed community values. In the name of preserving the land for posterity, it destroyed the culture. And I left Metzenbaum's staff after that, not because of that, but left with very real qualms about what had happened, moved to California, became a great fan of the central coast of California, Big Sur, which is unbelievably beautiful, pristine land. Senator Cranston, again, another former senator from California, very liberal, proposed legislation to do the same thing to Big Sur, to subject it to federal environmental controls when state and local controls were very good. It turns out it's one of those areas where property owners really love their land, and they take very good care of it. So I actually joined the fight against the Cranston bill, went back to Washington, testified against the Cranston bill, and supported the largely Republican effort to defeat the Cranston bill. And when I was finished with that, I felt I had done a good job and helped other people, joined a good movement, and I realized I was no longer on the side of the left, because the left has this programmatic and automatic reflexive assumption that federal control, federal protection is better, and I no longer, to say the least, accept that premise.
That must have been a fairly wrenching change for you to sort of admit to yourself, hey, I've started to change, because for many people, identification with the left liberal side of politics is almost like religion.
Well, people on the left who when I went back to Washington to actually join with property owners, oh my God, property owners, what a category. And I, in my own mind, I had the category. Property owners were people who were, quote, selfish. Well, that's an easy thing to hold in mind until you get to know people who own property. People who own property are people who own homes, and they take care of their homes. And they, you know, the United States, as well as other Western democracies, understood, John Locke understood, that property rights are crucial. All other rights flow from that. And the left has such a strong sense that property, private property, is something that's selfish and greedy. But when I saw that the federal one-size-fits-all solution doesn't fit, and when I saw people accusing me of selling out, I mean, I was a member of the Sierra Club at the time, and I was a member of the Wilderness Society, other American environmental groups, who I think in some respects still do a good job on some issues. I guess it was possible for me to continue to make the change and move away from the left because, at a personal level, I am very independent, and the same independence that allowed me open to liberalism in the first place, it was possible because I grew up in a conservative, in many ways reactionary part of the Midwest in the United States that was not really a genuinely conservative town, but was really racially and otherwise a reactionary town.
There were many aspects of that which were well worth rebelling against at the time, no doubt about it.
Well, that's right, and I, in my own mind, I thought, okay, this is what conservatives... I grew up in a town in Ohio where... conservatives, self-styled conservatives, made disparaging remarks about black people, and in fact the police would go into the black area of my hometown, not on a regular basis, but the blacks knew to keep their heads down, and when there were charges of police brutality, no one ever questioned that. And meanwhile, at least twice a year, the local Jewish synagogue was painted with swastikas. You know, everybody said, oh, what a terrible thing, but it still happened. And it was also an area of Ohio where people were more concerned, Christians seemed more concerned, well, Protestants, which is what Christians were in my area, Protestants were more concerned with the dangers of the Pope than they were with extolling Jesus. So with that kind of a background, I said, okay, 101, I'm 20 years old, little younger than 20. Gee, the left seems to be in favor of equality and humanity and fairness and goodness. The right seems to be reactionary, selfish, greedy people. Took me a long time to realize that that is not genuine conservatism, and in fact, liberalism of the kind that I join has now become in its own way as reactionary, as greedy, and as power-oriented as any other movement I've ever encountered.
You've written this essay, Leaving the Left. It's had quite a big impact on the right side of the blogosphere. A lot of blogs have linked to it. What kind of reaction have you had from your former colleagues on the left?
Well, I have to say, at a personal level, most of my friends support me because most of my friends are sort of liberal. They're left of center, but they're more libertarian. I know that's in some ways, it's hard to say whether a libertarian is right or left, but I know that's a huge controversy. But I have progressive friends who are more libertarian than not, might pay lip service to the liberal agenda, the left agenda, but are not wholly committed to it. So I haven't had too much a problem with them. Interestingly, I expected, since it was published, the article Leaving the Left was published in the San Francisco Chronicle, with San Francisco and Berkeley as two of the most notorious left-wing communities in the United States.
It was rather a rag to a bull, wasn't it?
It really was. And I have to say, I was looking forward to the response because my email address was linked to the article. Interestingly, I got a large number of responses from the Bay Area, and the vast majority of them surprisingly said something like this, and it was almost like a formulaic response in the sense that the same theme kept emerging. It said, "Thank you. I read your essay. I agree with a large part of what you say about the left. Now, I don't support George Bush on the following issues, you know, the war or the American judges to the appellate courts or anti-abortion and, you know, name several other issues. But many of them said, look, I call myself a leftist or a progressive or a liberal, and I no longer can tolerate the political correctness, the speech codes on campus, the shift from equal opportunity to equal results and equal outcomes. And I was impressed with that. I got a small but, you know, a significant but small number of people on the left who just were unbelievably vicious, you know, said easy things like, oh, you must be, Karl Rove must have sent you some money, so you're now a Republican, you must have hit your midlife crisis, you've decided to join the property owners. That's what one person said to me, you've decided to join the property owners. Well, the truth of the matter is I don't actually own any property right now. But I had to laugh because I remember when I used to parrot the same kind of line about property owners.
What's happening in culture and politics at the moment? There does seem to be this wave of, if not active embrace of a great deal of the right-wing agenda, certainly a backlash against political correctness, which seems to be the cutting edge of the left today.
I think so. I think there's been a growing, I think it's almost being registered at a subliminal level. It's like when you've lived in a relationship with someone, maybe it's a wife or a husband or a partner, or even a business partnership, and you registered discontent for a long time. You notice that the original romance is no longer there, but you might have some reasons to stay, including the fact that it's very hard to admit that you either were wrong or that you need to move on. We are all, I think, creatures of habit, and it's hard to make change. As much as we all like to think change is good, you know, in our personal lives, there's a whole culture of therapy now that tells us how good change is. But I think there's been a slow and a subliminal registering in the body politic, if you will, that things like equal opportunity in the civil rights movement have indeed shifted to equality of outcome. And there's no way to guarantee equality of outcome based on these amorphous measures of, quote, disparities, racial and gender disparities. Well, there are disparities. There are disparities in life, but the left has assumed and now posits that disparities are actually synonymous with culpable discrimination.
It's based on the idea that everyone is equal, and a quick glance around the room should be enough to disabuse anyone of that notion.
That's exactly right, and I know I used to use the term social justice a lot, and I've come to absolutely deplore that term, because justice by itself, justice when it exists, is always social. There's always a social element of justice, even if it involves an individual, you know, winning a case in court and getting justice. That serves the community, simply when justice is done. There's no such thing as non-social justice. Social justice is actually the term that is used by the left to say, okay, we have equal opportunity, but we still don't have the outcomes. If there are 40% or 48% of women in this state, then there should be 48% of women in all the industries and 48% of the women in all politics. And so social justice is now the term for all of the efforts of human beings through legislation and through the courts to enforce a vision of cosmic justice, as Thomas Sowell calls it. And so the term social justice is, for me now, a red flag when I know to put my hand over my wallet and be very careful who I'm in the room with.
That was Keith Thompson, author of Leaving the Left, which was published in the San Francisco Chronicle. I'm sure all of us on the right-wing side of the blogosphere wish him well and extend our heartfelt wishes that he doesn't get torn to shreds by enraged hippies. Actually, I had such a good talk with Keith that there's actually a lot more of it, so I'm going to play you that next week. But for the moment, that's it from Shire Network News. So from me, Tom Payne, on behalf of silentrunning.tv, until next week, may your God go with you.